Ruth Jackson was dying, and she knew it. On December 23rd, 1781, she mustered up the last bit of her strength to write a letter. Addressing it to a high-ranking political man, she begged to him, pleaded to him to take in her daughter, Nancy, who was the result of an affair with one of North Carolina's leading Revolutionary War generals. This made the letter a controversy waiting to unravel.
Welcome to Connecting the Docs, a podcast sharing true stories from the Old North State using materials found in the State Archives of North Carolina. Taking us through these stories and more, here's your host, John Horan.
Well, a controversy. I am looking forward to this one. My name is John Horan, and I'm your host today. Taking us on this journey will be two of my colleagues who know the most about this letter. First up, Caitlin.
Hi, I am Caitlin Martell, and I am a digitization archivist here at the State Archives.
Excellent. We've also got Annabeth.
Hi, I'm Annabeth Poe, and I am the podcast intern here at the State Archives.
Well, thanks again for being willing to take us through, because in this episode of Connecting the Docs, we will be investigating this letter, its content, and what happened after it was sent. This episode is in a three-part series where we uncover stories from the archives that have rarely been acknowledged. Each, in some way, represents profound strength within a system that consistently failed to recognize women and people of color for their contributions to the state of North Carolina. Now, however, we tell their stories. And in order to do that, I think, Caitlin, we need to hear your story.
Sure. So as I said, I am a digitization archivist here at the State Archives, which means that I digitize our materials to upload them onto our North Carolina digital collection page. And I also create metadata for the documents to make them more easily searchable online. And there's a bit of a misconception that digitizing archival materials is for the sake of preserving those materials, but that's not really the case, because if you preserve a document electronically, then you also have to preserve the technology needed to read that document, and that can become really hard to keep up with as technology progresses. There's actually a saying that digitized materials last forever, or for 5 years, whichever comes first. So digitization is really for accessibility. And that is really what drew me to digitization in archive settings, because it used to be that in order to see a document or study a document, you had to physically go to the place that it was being stored. And that is not accessible to everybody. And so that became really limiting on who could see these documents and therefore study these documents and contribute to the narrative around these documents. And history really is one big story, and it needs as many people contributing to that study as possible. And so in order to have the most people contributing to that narrative, it's really important that more people can access those documents. And so that's what I love about digital access in archives. And that's what brought me to finding this letter, was digitizing a collection for our America 250 project that we're working on. And this letter was found at the very end of the John Williams Papers collection that we have here in our private collections. And another way to think of private collections is personal collections, because these are materials that come from an individual or a family. It's a donation to the archive from, it could be a family that has held on to documents that have been passed down through wills, or it could be somebody who purchased documents at an auction. But either way, the individual is donating these materials to us at the archives. So that means, to compare it to other collections we have, it doesn't come from a state agency. It's not necessarily a state record of anything. It does deal with a personal collection. So this particular collection, like I said, was the John Williams Papers. And those are a collection of military and political correspondences from the Revolutionary War period. And it came to us because John Williams was very involved in North Carolina politics during the time of the Revolutionary War. In 1775, he served as the delegate from Granville County in the Provincial Congress and was elected to the North Carolina House of Commons in 1777 and 1778, where he was the Speaker of the House. And most notably, he was a delegate to the Continental Congress and signed the Articles of Confederation in 1778. So these papers that we have are very political. They are correspondences, but they talk about things having to do with the different Congresses that he was a part of, or someone needing some sort of supplies. So very military, very political. And then at the very end, there was a personal letter written by a woman named Ruthie Jackson. And finding that letter at the end of the collection was just mind-blowing, because just even having a letter from a woman from 1781 is exciting. And it didn't have anything to do topically with the rest of the collection. It's a military collection. It's a political collection. But here was this letter from a woman that was not related to John Williams, was not married to John Williams. And for the time, having a woman write a letter to a man that she was not related to or married to was kind of, I don't want to go as far as to say scandalous, but it was not the norm at all. And then the fact that it survived and they held on to it with these other letters. And yeah, it was included in the collection that we have. It was also kind of surprising to find, because this particular letter that we're going to discuss today, the Ruthie Jackson letter, is not mentioned in the finding aid of the collection. And so when you look at a collection, either online or when you pull the physical box, there is a finding aid that's included. And it's meant to be a brief overview of what is in the collection for research purposes. So you can kind of look at the finding aid and see what time period does this cover, who are the people that are involved in this collection, and then you can decide, is this worth actually looking at, or does it not have what I'm looking for? And if you look at the finding aid, it just talks about John Williams as a North Carolina political figure and his involvement in the Revolutionary War, and that these letters cover those topics. And there's no mention of the Ruthie Jackson letter. And so I didn't know that this letter was going to be in there. And we will definitely get into that more as we talk about it.
I mean, that's amazing that, you know, you would have had no idea when you were going into digitize that this letter even existed. And it happens that you find it amongst this other stuff that has nothing to do with it. And it sounds like the other things were addressed to him, or he wrote perhaps that about, you know, his political career and his military career. And this is a personal thing, which is totally different than everything else. Fascinating that it survived. So I'm interested, what is in this letter? What is the letter? What's the contents?
Well, I am happy to read it if you want to hear what it says.
Please.
All right. It is written from Hillsboro, North Carolina, and it is dated December 23rd, 1781. Dear Sir, within a few weeks, perhaps days, I shall bid adieu to existence, to a life the latter stage of which has been marked with multiplied disappointments and exquisite misfortune. Nature is now almost exhausted by long and painful disease, and I should have little cause to regret its final period were it not to separate me from a child whose tender years and unformed mind demand the care of protection of age and experience. You have often seen my daughter, Nancy, and with pleasure have borne testimony to the strong resemblance of her features and appearance to those of her deceased father. Pardon a mother's fondness. That softness of manners and sweetness of disposition so conspicuous in her father are not wanting in her, and are an earnest for the most promising hopes. She is the tender pledge of the mutual and sincere love to which she owed her birth, by which I attached myself to her dear father, your intimate friend. General Nash called her his with all the warmth of paternal love, and had he not been snatched so suddenly from the world, I should not at this critical moment have sought protection for her from a family to which she can boast no connection but that of humanity and general benevolence. Yet she has still a stronger claim. Her father was your bosom friend. Where can I apply? To whom address my dying request? To you, dear sir, and to your worthy lady, I implore permission to commit her. She is young, but yet she may be useful in your family, and in a great measure ease Mrs. Williams of the burden of her domestic concerns. I have taught her industry by the habitual practice of it, and inculcated upon her that upon this, and upon the most rigid attention to a purity of character, must depend her future happiness in life. My misfortune with one whose mind is enlarged as yours can never be imputed to her, and it will not restrain the offices of tenderness and friendship that the forms of the church did not give sanction to the union of her parents. Was it a sin? My sufferings have amply atoned for it, and my death should wipe it away forever. To her, it can never be imputed. She surely is as innocent as heaven. Farewell. The curtain will soon drop betwixt us forever. Should it be the employment of departed spirits to contemplate their connections left behind, it will minister to my joy to see my daughter sheltered under the guardian care of your worthy lady and yourself. Again, adieu. May every blessing attend you and yours. May your lives be long and happy, and their period without pain is the sincere prayer of your dying friend. Ruthie Jackson, to the Honorable John Williams, Esquire, Williamsboro.
That is some kind of letter. I mean, we'll talk about the contents, but just to start, the language is not a lot of people using bid adieu and betwixt. I'm not seeing it in any of my text chains. I'll say that anyway. That's amazing, you know. And then the contents is something else. What do you want to say about that?
I think, yeah, you definitely hit the nail on the head. When I saw it, like I said, at the end of this long list of very kind of mundane, routine, authoritative documents about political events and court hearings and things like that, to see something, I mean, the first line itself, when she says, I shall bid adieu to existence, I just thought, what is this? And I remember being just stunned as I kept reading it and just thinking, what am I holding? I mean, yeah, it was just very startling. But yeah, she's so earnest in her begging. I mean, she says, what else am I supposed to do? I don't know what to do. I loved her father. We weren't allowed to be married, but that doesn't mean we didn't love each other. That doesn't mean that we didn't love our child. And I don't know what else to do. He has already died. I am about to die. I don't know what to do with her. And you were best friends with her father. You know her. She knows you. And I don't know what else to do. Just please, will you and your wife take her in?
Yeah. And so Williams, we establish as a politician, but who are the other characters involved here? So we have, of course, Ruth Jackson. We have the daughter, Nancy. And then we have General Nash. These are the three other characters in this play. And how old is Nancy at this point? Do we know?
We don't know. It says in the letter a couple of different things that would give some kind of indication about her age. Ruthie says she is young, and she talks about her tender years and unformed mind, but she also says that she would be useful to your family. I've taught her domestic chores. She knows how to take care of the house. She knows how to take care of herself. So I don't think she's definitely not a baby, and she's definitely not, you know, at an age where she would need constant supervision. I think she's just maybe, I would guess, 8 to 10 years old, was what I was thinking, and Annabeth thought as well. Just based on kind of the language used to describe her, she's not old enough to be married. She's not old enough to look after herself completely. Part of Ruthie's kind of bargaining with the Williams family is she wouldn't be a burden to you. She would help you around the house. And she, you know, I've taught her well. She just needs a place to live for a little bit until I guess she's old enough to marry or look after her own house. So I would guess around 8 or 10.
Okay. And so that's Nancy's piece. And how about Ruth as the writer of this letter? What's her context?
Yeah, so this is actually how I got involved in helping research the letter. I helped try to track down Ruth and see if I could find any information about her. We found a secondary source. The name of the book is Nashville Tales, written by Louise Davis, which talks about Ruth and her connections to the Hillsborough area. So her dad was Philip Jackson, who owned a tavern in town. This tavern was frequented, according to the source, by a lot of political figures throughout the Revolutionary period, including people such as General Cornwallis. And that is probably, we can't say for sure, how she came in contact with John Williams, General Nash, because she worked as a barmaid in this tavern. And so that's probably how she met all of these people and made the connections that then led her to, you know, feeling like she could write this letter and connect with Nash before that.
It's interesting that the bar was, you know, both sides, Cornwallis and Nash. They're not bros. They're not friends.
It was completely fascinating to see that, you know, it was so popular among everyone, it seems.
It was also cool because we were actually able to find a surprising amount about the bar and about Philip Jackson, Ruthie's father.
Yeah, there were a lot of court records where he was basically asking people to pay him money for different offenses that had taken place. It didn't specifically cite what offenses they were, but he was in a bunch of different court records, you know, asking for this money to come in. So clearly he was a very infamous figure in the town, it seems.
Yeah, and he's out of the picture, presumably, when she writes this letter.
We assume so.
But we don't have any hard evidence on that score, right?
No, we do not. We tried to find Philip Jackson, some kind of estate or will or something of that nature in Hillsborough, but we came up empty-handed. Wherever we looked, he just wasn't in the records, so we don't know what happened to him.
The only records we were able to find him in were the court record. Yes. So we know that he was, you know, a real person and he really owned this tavern. And so that kind of cemented that. But unfortunately, we couldn't find his will.
Sure. Yeah. And we think that in this tavern is where Ruth meets Nash.
We think so.
Yeah. It chances are good because it was so popular, but we can't say for sure.
That's sure. The assumption we're working yes. under based yes. on what we do know.
Mm-hmm. And is it time to talk about Nash?
Sure. Yeah, let's get into it.
Let's go.
So Francis Nash was born actually in Amelia County, Virginia, which is now Prince Edward, Virginia. Around 1744 to Welsh immigrant parents, but his family moved to Hillsborough, North Carolina, sometime before 1763 and settled there. And Francis Nash started off by owning a store in Hillsborough and a law practice in Hillsborough. He was a lawyer by trade. And he, like John Williams, was a very prominent political figure before he became a prominent military figure. In 1763, he was appointed as clerk of the Superior Court and of the Inferior Court, so both courts of Orange County. And he represented Orange County in the Colonial Assembly and the First Provincial Congress. He represented Hillsborough in the Colonial Assembly, and he represented Halifax County in the Third Provincial Congress. So he, like Williams, had several different appointments in kind of the local government of the time. And then he kind of segued into the military side of things. He was captain of the North Carolina militia in the Battle of Alamance against the Regulators in 1771. And so then with the Revolutionary War in particular, in the summer of 1775, he was appointed as lieutenant colonel for the regiment that was called by the Provincial Congress. And after that, in 1776, he was promoted to colonel and commander of that regiment. And then he was the commander of that regiment in the Battle of Charlestown which was June 25th, 1776. And at that point, Nash's regiment was called up to join General George Washington and the Continental Army. But those plans changed because the British attacked Georgia. But the following year, in February of 1777, Nash was commissioned as the Brigadier General by Congress. And so that meant that he was now in charge of the entire North Carolina Brigade, which consisted of 9 regiments. So that was very high ranking for the state of North Carolina. In June of 1777, Nash led the North Carolina Brigade to Philadelphia, which was the U.S. capital at the time, and he was sent there to join up with George Washington and the Continental Army. And he fought alongside George Washington and the Continental Army in the Battle of Brandywine, which was in Pennsylvania in September of 1777. Then he, again, worked with George Washington to launch a counterattack against the British at the Battle of Germantown on October 4th, 1777. And that's where he was struck by cannon fire during that battle. And he was taken to a personal home nearby. And we know that that home was the home of Adam Gottwals. And it was on 40-foot road near Culpsville, Pennsylvania. So we know a lot about the actual house that he was taken to. And that was pretty common during the time when something like that would happen during the battle, to just kind of find the nearest house that could look after the injured person. The family of Adam Gottwals took General Nash in. And he spent 3 days there being cared for by that family. But he eventually did die. And it's said that his dying words were, "From the first dawn of the revolution, I have been ever on the side of liberty and my country." So very patriotic words on the deathbed of a Revolutionary War general.
Very well written.
Very well written. Very eloquent. Yes, yes.
I'm not sure I'll have that kind of
wherewithal,
however. But, that's fine. Good for him. Good for him.
But that that phrase, those dying words, kind of became his motto. And that was really what he was known for. In all of his memorials, that line was always included. And it kind of became what he was known for. And it really kind of perpetuated this figure of a true, you know, patriotic Revolutionary War general. He gave his life for the cause, for the revolution. He became kind of larger than life. He was buried on October 9th, 1777, and he was buried alongside 3 other officers who had been killed during that same Battle of Germantown. But Nash's burial was attended by George Washington and the generals of the Continental Army. So that really shows what a prominent burial that was for the time and how high up he was in the ranks of the military. And yeah, like I said, he really kind of became this North Carolina-based Revolutionary War hero pretty quickly after his death. And a lot of it was because of his dying words. They really kind of circulated around and really kind of rallied a lot of people back into the cause of the revolution. In 1784, Congress awarded his family a land grant that was equal to 84 months of service in the Continental Army. But he did not serve that long in the Continental Army. But it just kind of goes to show how revered he was, that Congress would kind of give his family payment for his service way more than he actually served. But because he did die in battle and because he was elevated to such kind of almost legendary status. The town of Nashville, North Carolina, Nashville, Tennessee, and Nashville, Georgia are all named for him, as well as Nash County, North Carolina. In 1906, a stone arch was built in his honor at the Guilford Courthouse National Military Park, and his home was declared a National Historic Landmark in 1971. So really just a very truly prominent figure from the Revolutionary period. So that's kind of who who we're dealing with when we hear about, you know, General Nash in the letter.
Larger than life is exactly right. But it seems like Ruthie, he wasn't necessarily a mythical figure to her. He was, in fact, in her life. And they were obviously together. And if it weren't for the church, they would have been together openly. But it seems like maybe they were openly together anyway. What do we know about that?
Yeah, so I actually found a record from the British Records Collection here at the archives. It was an agent's report on people's debt in Hillsborough. And it cited that Ruthie Jackson owed £69, which is about $6,000 according to the Bank of England today. But it said that when she contracted these debts, she was worth nothing. But she was a mistress to a gentleman in Hillsborough, which circumstances obtained her credit. So that shows that, like, seeing General Nash allowed her to support herself in some ways and, like, take out loans and stuff like that. So that's just really interesting that, you know, this letter makes it seem a little bit secretive, but according to this record, it wasn't that big of a secret.
I mean, this is British records.
Yeah, I mean, people in England knew about it.
Yes,
it seems not.
It's international. Yeah.
It's international.
Yeah.
Yes.
All in the tabloids.
Yes.
So it's not quite the secret, maybe, that the letter points towards. Although, you know, it's possible that maybe that's just us interpreting the letter. She might have just been writing this, you know, in that way, but in a poetic way and not necessarily a secretive way. But it's interesting.
I think also going back to how secretive was this, I think it had to be a certain level of secretive for the time. General Nash was married. He had two legitimate children. So, you know, in the late 1700s, having this sort of thing was definitely taboo.
Yeah, married two legitimate children. You're pointing that out. And so how many other children did he have?
There is record that he had an illegitimate son named Francis with a different woman. We don't know who the mother of that child was. We don't think it was Ruthie. She doesn't mention another child. There's no record of it being Ruthie's child. But it's interesting because the other child, the son, Francis, he seemed to do okay. He didn't need anyone imploring to take him in. And there's record of him having an apprenticeship. He was very kind of known as General Francis Nash's son. He was named Francis Nash, and he seems to be a little bit more publicly accepted. And I think that really speaks to gender norms of the time. He was a male, and General Nash's legitimate children were two daughters. So he did not have any other sons that we know of. And, you know, it was his namesake, and he got far with that. As we've said, General Francis Nash was kind of a hero. He was this kind of almost mythical guy, and he had this son, Francis Nash, and it didn't really seem to matter that he was not legitimate. He seemed to make it all right for himself in society and got an apprenticeship and was able to support himself. And that was not the case for Nancy, because she was a female and she could not get an apprenticeship or support herself in the same way that Francis could.
Like what you hear, but Raleigh is too far inland to get your history on?
That's a four-hour drive.
Well, come on down to the Outer Banks History Center in Manio, North Carolina, where we can serve you up a steaming slab of archival goodness with every visit. We got photographs, maps, books, manuscript collections, and oral histories. We even dabble in genealogy.
Who's your great-granddaddy?
If you want to know it, we're willing to show it at the Outer Banks History Center in Manio. Thank you for listening, and now back to the show.
I think at this point, it's sort of interesting to note, you know, in this particular collection, this letter is unique, as we've discussed already. It's unlike anything else in the Williams papers. But what about the situation? You know, and then also with Francis Nash Jr., I don't know if he was Junior, but I'm going to call him Junior. If in Francis Nash Jr.'s situation, what happened
to these children? You mentioned a little bit about the apprenticeship for Francis, but what happened to these children who were born out of wedlock?
Well, kind of like Caitlin said, it really depended on the situation. Like she mentioned gender, but it also depended on wealth, status within the community, how people were connected within that community. There were also situations where women could have money that could support a kid, but maybe they couldn't, you know, have a legal right to the child. Also fathers who were secretly paying women in situations like this. But there were legal outlets that people could turn to help ensure that children were taken care of while the parents were still alive and after they died. There are three main types of examples, and they all sought to prevent the state from ultimately having to take care of the child in these situations where parental rights and legal standing was in flux. The first of these type of records are bastardy bonds, which are kind of like modern day child support, but not reoccurring. It's a type of court record. And the archives actually has a collection that dates back in some counties to the 1780s. Women were brought into court and had to openly name the father of their child who was conceived out of wedlock. And sometimes these women came in on their own, hoping to get that payment from the fathers, but sometimes they were brought in or recommended to the court. I found a couple of these bastardy bonds that were addressed to the sheriff. So if that shows you the kind of environment that we're talking about, many of the women, when they were brought in, were either still pregnant or had just had the baby. So it was like very recent. There were some instances of older children being brought before the court for bastardy bonds, but not very many. The named man, of course, once they were named, had to come in and answer these charges. And a lot of times the court did award this financial support. On the records that I looked at, it was anywhere from 12 pounds to 100 pounds, usually 100 because the children are young, but the older they got, the less money the mothers received. And the children were rarely ever named in these documents.
What happens in the case that the sheriff is called? Like, who has to pay that?
Still the father has to pay it ultimately, but the woman would be brought, like, I guess, by the sheriff into court to name the father.
I appreciate that clarity. I'm not sure they appreciated being dragged in, but there you go.
Yes. So the second outlet that people could turn to in these kind of situations where parental rights were in flux was guardian bonds. The archives also has a collection of these dating back to the 1780s, but basically the court would appoint guardians for children. Oftentimes these children were orphans, but sometimes they were not orphans. There were a lot of reasons why a child would be brought before the court if they were not an orphan. And these were examples like not being able to take care of the child, hoping that by giving up guardianship, the parent would ensure that they would have a better life. Sometimes when women got remarried, the child from their previous marriage was brought to the court, like, because her new husband would not take in the child and take care of it. And so that was another outlet that people could use. And again, it really depended on circumstances as to why these children were being assigned guardians by the court. But mainly it was in cases of orphanage, but there were other instances where they were not. And then the third bond, Caitlin has already mentioned the apprentice bonds that Francis Nash's son, Francis Nash, was apprenticed to a person in Hillsborough. But these are also formal court contracts that promise children to local craftsmen in order to learn the trade until they reached adulthood. This includes learning how to be a blacksmith, how to be a tailor, how to be a cobbler, a carpenter, I think was also an occupation that children could be apprenticed into. Usually the child was very young, oftentimes less than 10. They would have to often leave home immediately and move in with the assigned person who was going to teach them the different trade. This was used sometimes by single mothers to connect children to more respectable social positions instead of being a child that was born out of wedlock. In these contracts, the person who was serving as the apprentice had to promise to teach the child and keep them in their care for their whole life. So it wasn't optional. They couldn't decide, you know, oh, this person's not good at this job. It was a binding contract for life. So the child was basically shipped off to learn the trade.
Wow. So it's not like in Les Mis where you know, she was done and they didn't like her. So she was doing the sweeping up. They had to actually do what they said they were going to do. And if it didn't work, tough for everybody.
Yes, exactly. In terms of Francis Nash, too, there were ways around this. There was one record, a secondary source, that said that Francis Nash actually fled his apprenticeship. So he had this apprentice bond. I think it was to a silversmith, but then he fled it and was never really seen or heard from again. So there were instances where you could find ways out of the types of bonds, but they didn't leave a trace.
Yeah, it's just easier to kind of get away from it all. And it seems like, and that might be the only choice you have if you're not interested in what's going on. So, but you've done a lot of research on this, and it seems like there are 100 counties in North Carolina right now. And it seems like you had to narrow your focus down. So what counties did you specifically target and why?
Yeah. So when I was looking through all of these different types of bonds, I specifically zeroed in on Orange and Granville counties to try to figure out what happened after the letter was sent to John Williams, what happened to Ruthie Jackson, what happened to Nancy, her daughter. And there was basically no evidence. I looked in Granville County, which now the part that John Williams would have lived in is part of Vance County, but there was no evidence there of any kind of guardian bond for Nancy, and there was also nothing in the Orange County court records, just where Hillsborough is, to show that Ruthie and Nancy went through any kind of legal process at this point before or after Ruthie wrote the letter and we assume passed away. But this did allow us to figure out what other documents to look for traces of Nancy and Ruthie's lives. We ended up reviewing wills, estate documents, and land deeds in addition to the court bonds that I've already mentioned.
Yeah, so what'd you find?
The short answer is not much. At first, we were really coming up empty no matter where we looked. There was no bastardy bonds, no guardianship bonds, no apprentice bonds that I could find for Nancy, which I've already mentioned. Doesn't mean they don't exist out there somewhere, just not labeled and difficult to track down. However, we did find some references to Ruthie and Nancy's lives in secondary literature that then led us to other archival sources to try to track down what happened to them. I mentioned the British Record Collection here at the archives earlier that showed that Ruthie Jackson had a debt. She was the only woman mentioned in the whole document, but it did have her marital status after all of this went down with General Nash. It said that after her affair with Nash, she got married to a man named Thomas Farmer, who was listed as a tailor in Hillsborough.
Thomas Farmer, that's another name that's gotta be yes. Easy to sift
through. Oh yeah,
very unique.
Yeah, Thomas Farmer.
Definitely not multiple of those anywhere. But in the same document where it said Ruth had debt, it said that Thomas Farmer, a tailor in Hillsborough, also had debt. So we were able to connect this, the Thomas Farmer that was mentioned in Ruth's section to the Thomas Farmer that had his own section. It said that after Ruthie had died, which it mentioned in the part about her debts, that this Thomas Farmer had moved to Nashville. So that might be why we kept coming up empty on a lot of these records, because they may be in Tennessee. But Thomas Farmer's entry did say that he owned £1. That was his debt, which translates to roughly $100 today. But it also mentioned that at some point in his life, he had land, some type of livestock, one enslaved man, and a horse. So it has this really detailed information about Thomas Farmer. In the same entry, it talks about, of course, him being a tailor, but it also says that he was only a good tailor if he could refrain from drinking to excess. That is specifically mentioned in the record about his debt, which is...
It's a bad beat.
Yeah. It's not looking too good.
Because they don't really give a lot of personal information in these debt entries.
I've seen them. They're pretty straightforward. This person owes that person. So if this person is pointing out that this is a tailor, and you want straight lines out of your tailor, let's be honest.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, don't get poked around with somebody who's drunk. So that is tough that it makes it in this document, and we're talking about it 250 years later.
Yeah.
Yes, but it was just fascinating that that is specifically what they wanted to point out. But then in the same document, we also found another entry that was interesting to us for our research for this podcast. We found an entry for General Nash himself. It labels him, in contrast to Thomas Farmer, who drinks to excess, General Nash is labeled as a respectable man and said that he had debts totaling over 236 pounds or close to $21,000 today. But unlike Ruthie and Thomas, who still had debt, Ruthie's debt was absolved after she died, but Thomas still was listed as having debt. General Nash's debt had been paid. It specifically lists his brother-in-law and his son-in-law as using his vast valuable property as collateral for this money that he owed, which is just very interesting to see the stark differences between the way that Thomas Farmer and General Nash and Ruthie Jackson all appear in the same document, really highlighting the information that they thought was important about each one. For Ruthie, that was that she was married and that she was a mistress to General Nash. For Farmer, it was, you know, basically where he moved and the fact that he was...
ne'er-do-well.
And then for General Nash, it was that he was respectable and had so much property and stuff like that, which could be a sign that, you know, it is relating to debt and finance, but also it shows the difference in status that these three people had. Just with one record.
Well, as we mentioned earlier, Nash, his family was awarded by Congress a land grant equal to 84 months of service in the Continental Army. So we know that his debts here were paid off by his brother-in-law and son-in-law through their land ownings. So it's possible that that is what they used that for.
Yeah, and on the same wavelength, we also found this other primary source talking about Francis Nash's land. It's the same source that I mentioned earlier, Nashville Tales, which was written by Louise Davis. And it talks about General Nash actually gifting Ruthie Jackson land at some point during the 1760s, 1770s, before he died. The exact quote from the secondary source is, "When pretty Ruthie Jackson bore Nash's daughter, he provided generously for them, deeding to Ruthie a plantation called Whitty's Place west of Hillsborough and several slaves for the care of the place." Now, this is not something that we could actually find any primary sources to substantiate. We looked for them. I looked through land deeds specifically, court records, all of that kind of thing. We couldn't find it anywhere, but this was mentioned in several other secondary sources and not just this one, which I think also speaks to, like, his status and like the way in which their relationship was reflected while they were alive and then after.
Yeah, it seems to maybe be either come from the myth of the man or as a result of, because if it is true that she has this plantation, unless Thomas Farmer came in and squandered it all away, what's she writing this letter for? If she's set up, she doesn't seem to need the letter, and we have the letter in front of us.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly our thought as well. When we found out that she had been married legally to Thomas Farmer, we were really shocked because there's no mention of a husband at all. The only person she mentions is General Nash and, you know, their love for each other and how they would have been married if they could have. She doesn't mention having any land or any prospects in that regard. So when we were looking at the debt records and then what we know from the letter, kind of several potential scenarios came to mind. Maybe at this point, Thomas Farmer, to his excessive drinking, had squandered away their land and their ownings. Maybe Ruthie didn't feel comfortable leaving Nancy in Thomas's care if he was such an excessive drinker.
It also could be that even though it says he gave her the land, it wasn't incredibly common for women to own a lot of land at that point. So it could have stayed in his name.
Yes.
And then when Francis Nash died, it transferred into his estate and then was divided in that way. I was able to find some court records of Alfred Moore, who was his brother-in-law, also the executor of his will, selling tracts of the Nash land in Hillsborough to different people in the community. So that very well could have been the land that she was living on that then was sold as part of his estate.
Yeah. So several options there.
Yeah, just quite a bit going on. And you're going to tell us about the will? So is this the minute that we learn about that we get this twist in the story?
It's another twist. Yeah, it will not be the last. So like Annabeth said, we, in searching for Ruthie Jackson in particular, Nancy Nash Jackson in particular, finding documents about women from this time period are hard. And that was another reason why this letter stood out so much, was that it was written by a woman and it survived. But we went to kind of look through, which unfortunately, when doing this sort of historic research, you have to do, you have to look at it through the documents that remain from the male side. And that's wills, land grants, deeds, estate records, things like that. So we started looking through wills. That is a good way to kind of see who the heirs are. So who's left. So we found General Nash's will, and we were so shocked by it because we were looking through the microfilm and we kept thinking, okay, we can skip this part because it's too short. It's going to be a long will because he's this, you know, well-known figure. Well, we were wrong.
Mr. Big Time.
It was about a paragraph.
Wow.
And it was written on May 3rd, 1777. And we know from his records in the Revolutionary War that at that time he was kind of in between battles, but that was after he had taken over the North Carolina Brigade. So that was kind of the height of his status in the military. And that was also just a few months before he ended up dying. So it was quite timely. Of course, he couldn't know that. But it was written with a lot of haste. It's very short. It leaves everything to his wife, his legal wife. And we were thinking maybe part of the reason why no one else is mentioned in this will, namely Ruthie or Nancy, is because General Nash's will was not administered in Granville County or in Orange County, which is where we started looking, but it was administered in Brunswick County, which was founded by General Nash's father-in-law. And General Nash's father-in-law probably presided somewhat over this writing of the will. So kind of hard to include your mistress and illegitimate child when your father-in-law is writing your will. but yeah, it was a very short will, a lot of just haste, and it was not written in his near his home. So yeah, we kind of took that to think that he had gotten very high up in the military, and things were really kind of heating up with the war. And I think he knew that I need to write something really quick to make this legal and legitimate. And then, like we said, just a couple months later, he did end up dying in battle.
So that is the story of Nash's will. But this isn't the Nash collection. It's the Williams collection. But there wasn't a will there. So do we have any mention of his will?
We do.
Okay.
We were able to find John Williams' will. And actually, kind of exciting, we were able to find his wife's will, which was kind of rare for the time. As we said, it's you look through the male documents. So we looked through John Williams' will to see who his heirs were. And there is no mention of Nancy. But again, we weren't totally surprised by that because she would not have been his legal heir. She was not his child in any way. So we weren't totally surprised by that. But it was helpful down the line when we were trying to figure out what did happen to Nancy.
And what did happen to Nancy? I'm dying here.
So I think the million-dollar question is, did John Williams take Nancy in? And to answer that, we ended up going to the census. And this letter was written December 23rd, 1781. And 1790 was the first federal census in the United States. So we started there and we found John Williams. And it listed 4 free white females living in the household of John Williams in 1790. So going back to John Williams' will, and the will of John Williams' son-in-law, Robert Burton, and looking through the family Bible of Robert Burton. We kind of did some genealogy calculus. And what we found was John Williams and his wife married in 1759. His wife was a widow. She had a daughter, Agatha, from her previous marriage. We know from the family Bible that Agatha was born October 6th, 1757. So she was about two when Agnes, her mother, married John Williams. John Williams took Agatha in and raised her as his own. She actually ended up with the last name Williams, even though that was not her biological last name. We also know Agatha was mentioned in her biological father's will. So we had kind of double confirmation of Agatha's date of birth. So Agnes, the wife of John Williams, she died in 1803. So there were two censuses that we were looking at here, the 1790 census and the 1800 census. John Williams died in 1799, so he was not in the 1800 census. His wife would have been in both. And for our sake, we are interested in accounting the free white females in the family. Agatha, their daughter, died in 1831. So she would also be in the 1790 and 1800 censuses. In 1775, Agatha, John Williams' daughter, married Robert Burton. And there is record of them moving in with John Williams and living in their house on their land, which was very common at the time, especially for such a prominent family. That would have been the norm for sure. Agatha and Robert had 12 children, but they only had three daughters. And we know this from Robert's will and from the family Bible. So Agatha and Robert's first daughter was born in 1783 and died in 1796. So she would have been accounted for in the 1790 census, but not in the 1800 census. Their second daughter was born in 1793, and she is listed in Robert Burton's will, which was executed in 1825. So she would not have been in the 1790 census, but she would have been in the 1800 census. Their third daughter, same situation. She was born in 1795, but is in Robert Burton's 1825 will. So she would not have been in the 1790 census, but would have been in the 1800 census. So in the 1790 census, there would be Agnes, John Williams' wife, Agatha, their daughter, and Agatha's first daughter. That's three free white females. Four free white females are listed in the census. So who is that unaccounted for free white female?
Is it Nancy? We don't know.
We don't know, but we feel like it was.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like it's strongly possible. Do we have the 1800 census?
We do.
And what's the numbers there?
There are four free white females listed in the census, and we have those accounted for. It would be Agnes, Agatha, and their two surviving daughters who were born in 1795 and 1793. So in the 1800 census, all the free white females are accounted for from wills, family Bible records, things like that. That to us did not signify that it was not Nancy in the 1790 census, because even though we don't have Nancy's exact date of birth, like we said earlier, we could assume she was around 8 to 10 when she wrote the letter in 1781. By 1800, no matter when she was, she would have been too old to still be living. We know that Agatha, John Williams' daughter, was 43 in 1800 census. So Nancy, she would have been too old, really, for it to make sense for her to still live there. So that didn't really raise any sort of red flag to us that it's not Nancy in the 1790 census. We also don't know exactly when Ruthie Jackson died. We know she did die. In the debt records, it says she died near the close of the war. So this letter was written the very end of 1781. We can assume she died 1782, not past 1783. So it's not too much longer from the time of this letter and Ruthie's death to the 1790 census, but there's quite a bit of time between the 1800 census. So we were more focused on what does the 1790 census say. And like we said, there should only have been 3 free white females, and there were 4 in the census records.
Yeah, unless he's got another person writing a note to him and highly unlikely the situation. It's a pretty good assumption.
The other big kind of evidence for us was the letter survives. You know, their family held on to this letter, and I don't know why you would hold on to the letter if you didn't take in the child in the letter.
Yeah, you don't usually hold on letters that bring shame.
Exactly. So here's this child we didn't take in one time.
It's not generally how it works.
Mm-hmm.
I get that. I'm with you.
Yes. Another thing that was kind of crazy was John Williams' grandson, who is all over John Williams' will. He left pretty much everything, too, is named Francis Nash Burton.
Yeah, they were really close friends. Mm-hmm. Look at that.
And there is a letter in the John Williams papers from Francis Nash to John Williams. It's not a very personal letter because, as we said, the collection is not personal letters, but it is proof of connection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow. Wow. So what happens to the letter now?
Well, as I said, the whole reason I came across this letter was I was digitizing the John Williams papers for America 250, which is a massive joint project that we are doing. And ultimately, it will end up online as part of the John Williams papers collection. And I think kind of the main thing is people know about the letter now. It was not known. It wasn't hidden by the family. They kept the letter with all of his other papers. And there aren't any other personal correspondences that we have in this collection. So the family, there was no shame, it seems like, from the family's perspective. But it's strange because as soon as it came to the archives, this Ruthie Jackson letter, just all traces of it disappeared. It's not in the finding aid. If you look for it online, there's no mention of it. So that's what I wanted to do, was bring it out of the shadows and talk about it. And I can tell you it's in the finding aid now.
Well, that's great. Great work on that point, on that score.
And I think it just really, like we said, it really highlights there's so many layers, and that's what Annabeth and I kept coming back around to. We just kept realizing there's so much, this letter. And I think that's what's so exciting about archival work, is that you really never know what you're going to find. And, you know, I just stumbled across this letter in my daily work, and all this research came out of it. And it really highlights, like we said, gender roles at the time, and kind of the difference between holding on to documents from men as opposed to holding on to documents from women.
I think it also shows the different places you can look for records when you're really struggling to find one. We looked through bastardy bonds, we looked through guardian bonds, we looked through court docket minutes, we looked through the British records. There's all of these different places that you can go if you hit a dead end. And you still might keep hitting dead ends, but you can still keep going and looking for these people that, you know, maybe are in the margins of these documents.
Yeah. I mean, like we said, there's no record of Nancy anywhere other than this letter in all of our materials here. And you just have to wonder who else, how many other Nancys are there out there where, you know, they just because of the social norms of the time, for whatever reason, they weren't allowed to kind of make it on their own. And does anything survive from them? But yeah, just how many other people just kind of fell through the cracks?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if we can't know if there's anything in there. There's nothing obvious. But hopefully, you know, the Nancys and the Ruths of the future will find a Caitlin who will find them and bring them back out for the rest of us. That's the goal. That's the idea. I think this story has been filled with twists and turns. It's been fabulous. I mean, just all over the shop with people coming around who have debts, and then people who are respectable who also have debts, bigger debts, but they're fine because they're respectable and war heroes. The other guy's just a drunk tailor, so whatever. And then, you know, you have beautifully written letters, and all of this is now out there for people to read and to listen to and to engage with.
And also to research. If you want to get in on this and try to find, if you can see any traces of Nancy and Ruthie, we will be glad to hear about it.
We absolutely will be glad to hear about that. And so, you know, I want to say I appreciate your time. Thank you for sitting down and bringing this letter to light and showing us the all of the work that it takes when you find one letter. It's fantastic. So thank you both.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for shining a light on Ruthie and Nancy.
Yes.
Absolutely.
That was not for a long time.
So. Yes. Yes, absolutely. So thank you both. And thank you for listening. This is Connecting the Docs. For now, I'm your host, John Horan. And I want to thank both of my guests, Caitlin and Annabeth. Thank you both for being on. And then I want to thank my producers, Shauna Carr,
Danny Shrella,
and Courtney Hamlin. And then Josh Hager and Katie Crittmore are also producers on the show. And then finally, I want to thank the voice you hear at the beginning and end of every podcast, Judy Allen Dotson.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Season 4 of Connecting the Docs. Don't forget to like, rate, and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, so you'll never miss an episode. If you like this show, you might want to check out our blog, History for All the People.